Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work. Enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Mikaitis.
Hello, and welcome to episode 848 with Sally Helgeson. Inclusion is a hot topic these days, and Sally is one of the most decorated researchers, authors, trainers on the topic, and she brings the goods in terms of real, practical ways that teams can be made better through simple practices we can all pick up and enjoy, enhancing performance and good vibes and inclusion. Great stuff from Sally. So you'll learn, one, the merits of true inclusivity, two, why it pays to give folks the benefit of the doubt, and three, how to manage your triggers effectively. So if you want to check out the show notes or the transcript or the links to items that we've referenced, please drop on by awesomeatyourjob.com/EP848. Now here's a little bit about Sally. Sally Helgeson has been cited in Forbes as the world's premier expert on women's leadership, and she's also an internationally bestselling author, speaker, and leadership coach honored by the Thinkers 50 Hall of Fame. Her most recent book, How Women Rise, co-authored with Marshall Goldsmith, examines the behaviors most likely to get in the way of successful women, and its rights have been sold in 22 languages. She's written some other great stuff, including The Web of Inclusion, A New Architecture for Building Great Organizations, which has been cited in the Wall Street Journal as one of the best books on leadership of all time, and is credited with bringing the language of inclusion into business. Big thanks to Sally for sharing her wisdom with us, and big thanks to our sponsors. Check them out. Now, here's Sally. Sally, welcome to How to Be Awesome at Your Job.
Thank you, Pete. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk about your book, Rising Together, How We Can Bridge Divides and Create a More Inclusive Workplace. Well, Sally, I'd love to kick it off by hearing about a particularly surprising, fascinating, counterintuitive discovery you've made along the way when it comes to this inclusion stuff, since you've been studying it for quite some time.
Yeah, Pete, I'd say the thing that most jumps out at me is that the approach to inclusive cultures that's taken in many organizations, which focuses on unconscious bias, is possibly the least effective focus that we can take. And I know a lot of people have been through unconscious bias trainings, and sometimes they can stir real insights, and sometimes they can make us pretty angry. But whatever the response, they usually don't lead us with much of a path forward to creating more inclusive relationships, getting along better with people we perceive of as different from ourselves, or creating inclusive teams or cultures in the organization.
That's intriguing. Let's dig into that. And maybe first, just to make sure we're all on the same page with regard to terms, what do we mean by being inclusive fundamentally?
I think an inclusive culture, whether it's a team, whether it's an organization, whether it's a community, we always know it because it is one in which the largest possible percentage of people feel that they are valued for their potential, not just their contribution. So they really feel seen and feel as if they are part of a we, not a they. So it's a real culture of belonging in that sense. And that's why it's kind of the acid test. If you have a culture and people talk about the organization, say, or the team as a they, you can be pretty sure that they're not perceiving it as inclusive.
Yeah, that's powerful. Or the corporate, they, you know, like the other folks.
Exactly. So there's no possible way that the person who's using the word they perceives themselves as really seen or valued. So that's how we know.
Okay. And so fundamentally, what are some of the key drivers that get in the way of having a real big we?
A lot of times people are concerned about or shy about or fearful of saying things for that they might imagine would offend somebody who they perceive as having a different background, different values, people across gender, race, age, ethnicity, etc. So people may feel and sort of do a self-censoring, so they don't really feel like they're being themselves when they're talking to people who they perceive as being different. And then the other person picks up on that and recognizes that they're rather stiff because of this perception of difference. So that's one of the things that can get in the way. On the other hand, another thing that can get in the way is we can have an awareness of what someone else might perceive as problematic. So a lot of it comes down to both of those situations I'm describing is trying to read other people's minds and figure out what they might be thinking. Much better to be really transparent and to just ask questions. You know, how do you like to be spoken to? What enables you to bring your best talents to work? What talents do you have that may not be viewed? Is there anything that really upsets you when people say it? Those kinds of conversations are really helpful at building relationships across boundaries in the workplace.
Okay. And you say something that often is not getting the job done is unconscious bias training. Could you paint a picture for what does unconscious bias training look, sound, feel like in practice so folks can sort of recognize that? It's like, oh yeah, I did one of those a few years ago. And then why isn't it getting the job done?
Well, what it looks like in practice often, and of course there's some unconscious bias training is more effective than others, but basically what it looks like is people being asked either through a test or through conversation to understand where they might have biases, prejudices, beliefs about people. It can be anything, you know, it can be gender or race, but it could also be people with tattoos on their necks or whatever it is. So something that really tests and helps you identify what your beliefs are is where it's focused. And that can be fine as far as it goes, but there's no how there. There's now how do you move forward from that? As someone I worked with once said, it's all aha moment and no now what. We don't know how to proceed. And what I've tried to do in Rising Together and in the work I've been doing generally for decades is focus on the how. What are the practices? People perceive us based on our behaviors, not on our biases, really, whatever happens to be running through our heads at the time. That's how they're impacted. That's how they're affected. So I think a stronger approach is to start by practicing more inclusive behaviors with people. It's also easier to, as I like to say, to act our way into new ways of thinking, as opposed to thinking our way into new ways of acting. Because, you know, once we try out something, we may learn something about it. And so then we'll think, okay, well, you know, for example, you might think, well, this person seems to be this way. And then you have a conversation with them and you realize that your presumption was wrong. But if you were trying first to address what was in your head, what your thoughts were, you wouldn't have any evidence to begin changing. So it's interesting that we seem to often get it backward. We think we need to change our minds so that we can change our behaviors rather than change our behaviors so that we can change our minds.
Well, that is powerful, Sally. And I was just about to ask if some folks have had the unconscious bias training and they had the aha moments, but not the now what. I was just going to ask. So folks have determined, okay, I've got some unconscious bias against people with tattoos or trans people or Trump voters. I mean, you name it. You have some unconscious bias about any grouping of folk. What is the now what? And maybe it sounds like your answer is maybe don't even bother to think yourself into new ways of acting. Is that fair? Or are there some useful thought to action approaches as well?
No, I think it should be action to thought rather than thought to action. It can really keep us stuck because then we're thinking, well, what about this person? Well, what if they, et cetera, et cetera. So I would really recommend in those situations going to action. We've all had this experience where you go into a store and it looks like you're going to have a slightly hostile encounter. So you practice being almost aggressively nice to that person. You act as if you never noticed any hostility from them. You act as if they were treating you superbly. Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. You know, without being too sucky up, but, you know, acting as if you don't notice that they're treating you in a slightly disrespectful way. often, not always, but often, they will kind of, you'll be cueing them. Oh yeah, you know, I am a nice person. This person, okay, they seem to be responding to me in a positive way. And 9 times out of 10, they'll switch their response to you. I know I've watched this be true throughout my life. Somebody's water is dripping down from their bathtub in an apartment above mine. And I know it's because they were having kind of a lost weekend. And I knock on the door and say, I can't believe you would, and all that kind of stuff. Well, it's going to escalate. If I go up there and trying to diffuse the situation by giving them the benefit of the doubt, you know, I'm sure you didn't realize this, but the water in your bathtub overflowed and it's doing whatever it is. And I'm sure this isn't something that that you had any awareness of. Then they'll, oh, well, okay, I'm so sorry, et cetera. You know, it's, we don't do this. And part of the issue in the workplace today is people are kind of primed to be on the search often for microaggressions or does that person think or what about their response? And so we're not accustomed to diffusing those situations. We feel like we have to react to them.
Well, I was going to ask specifically about giving people the benefit of the doubt. I think most folks are generally familiar with what that phrase means, but could you expand upon, in practice, what are the thoughts, the assumptions, the practices that one embodies when they are just habitually giving people the benefit of the doubt as their default way of being?
Well, I'm not advocating passivity, because passivity, when we do that, what I'm really talking about is being able to write a script for yourself. Okay, somebody, let's talk about gender. So a woman thinks, oh, you know, men just can't listen to women. She feels unheard in a situation. Men just can't listen to women. If we just kind of passively accept that or grab a friend and complain, you know, I can't believe that guy, men can't, et cetera, that's not an approach that's going to be helpful. But often just saying, you aren't listening to me, men can never listen to women, that's not a good path forward either. So we want a way to give that person the benefit of the doubt. So in our head, we can write a script, you know, maybe he couldn't hear what I was saying because there was noise in the room. Or maybe I didn't phrase this using language that was that familiar to him. I think I'll give it another shot. Then you go to the person and you say, you know, I noted that you didn't seem to hear what I said in that meeting, and I figured it might be helpful to you if I were to rephrase it. And then you do that. Well, usually they're not going to say, no, you didn't. I didn't hear what you said because I wasn't interested or because I have a terrible time hearing women. Generally, they're going to say, oh, okay, thank you. And then you have a way to begin a constructive situation. So it's neither defensive nor is it passive. Now, what is so remarkable? And I've used this in coaching for quite a while. What is so remarkable about this technique of writing a new script is that it is effective whether or not we believe that person really earned the benefit of the doubt. If we think that they might have intentionally said something to us in a way that bothered us, or if we think that this is part of a pattern with them, that they never really listened to us in a fruitful or effective way. Even if we think that, if we write that script and then act as if we believe it, it will usually serve us better than the stock response or negative script that we've been invested in the past. It will usually serve us better. And it will also give us a path to potentially building more of a relationship with that person where they could serve in some way as an ally for us, and we could serve as an ally for them. So it's very effective, even if we don't necessarily buy it. And knowing that you don't necessarily buy it is where part of your power lies in doing this. Because it's not a Pollyanna, oh, they must be a wonderful person, even though It's a very realistic testing and probing to see, to discern an alternate path so that you can connect with that person.
All right. That's beautiful. Thank you. Well, now I want to hear, in your book, Rising Together, you identify 8 common triggers that undermine our ability to connect. Could you first define, what do you mean by trigger? And then can you give us the quick rundown of each of these 8?
Sure. What I mean by trigger is any situation or stimulus in our environment that stirs an emotional response in us.
Now, is it negative emotional response?
It can be a negative or it can be a positive response. I mean, triggers can be positive as well as negative.
Okay. I'm delighted by this.
Yeah, exactly.
You've triggered delight within me, Sally. Okay.
Wonderful, Pete. I'm so glad to hear it. So they can be negative or they can be positive, but it's the negative ones, obviously, that are more likely to undermine us in the workplace. So that's why I'm focusing on triggers that can often stir a negative response. But what's important to recognize is that they're environmental. They happen in the environment. So we can't really control what triggers us. They lie outside our circle of control, if you will. We can only find a more effective way to manage them than we may already be doing. So I think we waste our time by trying to create an environment in which we are shielded from any potential triggers. And that's what's happened to a lot of younger people coming into the workplace, because in their colleges and universities, there's such an emphasis on trigger warning, et cetera.
All right.
Guess what? Our environment is always going to give us trigger warnings. What we need is to understand an effective way to address them.
Could you then share with us some of these common triggers?
Yeah, a couple of them that really stand out. One is visibility, which we don't necessarily think of as a trigger, but it really can operate, and it can operate in a number of ways. Number one, we can feel triggered by people we feel are very good at being visible. Oh, he's such a showboat. He's always talking about himself. He's that kind of person. You know, I'm a wonderful person. I'm not like that. Or we can just simply feel triggered by our own lack of visibility. You know, oh, nobody ever notices me. I guess, you know, I'm just not the kind of person who grabs attention. Oh, well, I know that I'm a good person and, you know, this, that, or the other, you know, a couple of my friends like me. But we're being triggered by that reaction. Or we can, if we are really good at it, and I've seen this with senior executives I've worked with, if we're really good at it, we can be triggered by people who are not good at positioning themselves to be visible. We can think, we can dismiss them. Oh, well, he's not a player. He's not very good at bragging on himself or tooting his own horn. He seems to have some moralistic inhibition against doing it. So I'm not going to waste my time with him. I've heard that a lot from people who are good at it. So it can trigger us in all kinds of ways. But here you see, this is a really good demonstration of how triggers work. What they do is they stir up a kind of automatic or stock response in us. Well, he's a showboat. I don't want to be like him. And I've heard people say this for years. Yeah, well, if I have to act like that jerk down the hall to get noticed in this organization, no, thank you. Why is he a jerk? Because he gets noticed? Maybe learn from him. So they stir up a stock response, and then that response keeps us from being able to think of a more positive way to address the situation. Okay, I see that I am being triggered by that person's skill at getting noticed. I wouldn't necessarily want to use the same techniques, but I think that there is probably something I can learn here. Maybe I'm going to start watching him and thinking about how I might rephrase things he says in a different way, a way that's more comfortable for me. For example, if he's saying, well, that I had that client eating out of my hand, we might think, okay, that's helpful. Maybe it would be more useful for me to phrase it, well, that client and I really bonded together. but it's helpful to understand and watch what he's doing in a constructive way. So that we're rewriting that script. Hey, here's someone I can learn from.
Yeah, that's powerful in terms of the notion of our automatic response, and it just closes down a whole universe of possibility and opportunity. And I think we do this all the time with so many things.
We do.
Can you tell us, Sally, what are some ways to catch ourselves in the moment, regardless of what the trigger is?
Well, I think number one, when we recognize ourselves going into telling ourselves a story that's kind of negative and defensive, or telling ourselves in particular a story that's very self-serving about who we are. Well, I'm not the kind of person who would ever. The minute we hear ourselves telling ourselves that kind of story in our heads, we should recognize that, okay, I'm probably being triggered. Now, what is triggering me here? In this case, it's the fact that I feel that that person is better at getting noticed than I am. Okay, that's triggering me. How could I rewrite this or take a different path of action that would be more helpful to me, that would serve me better and might also help me figure out a way to connect better with this person instead of judgmentally dismissing them? So defensiveness, judgment, self-serving narratives, these are all keys that we are being triggered. And if we want to address them, we should take heed and then think about how we might more skillfully and usefully respond.
Okay. Well, so given those things to be on the lookout for, could you share with us another one of the common triggers called "that's not funny"?
That's not funny. Exactly. These are triggers that are based around humor. And humor has become, I think, a really challenging thing to deal with in today's workplace, because people have different perceptions in terms of what they think is funny. Also, jokes, especially jokes that would have been acceptable and thought of as sort of fresh and interesting a number of years ago, now have a way of giving offense to a lot of people. And that has made humor to some degree really challenging in the workplace.
Well, Sally, could you give us an example of a joke or piece of humor or reference that might have been fine and dandy 5 to 10 years ago and now is, risky business?
Yeah, you know, any joke that has to do with gender, lots of jokes that were in the workplace, I don't want to necessarily repeat them right now, that had to do with women who were sort of hot quantities, or presumption that men were always trying to seduce women in one way or another. Those kinds of jokes. I came of age, I was in the madman era when I started working. I worked in advertising and it was really like madman. And there was all kinds of stuff that today would get somebody fired on the spot that was happening. So there are a lot of people who kind of come from that era or just a bit afterwards, when it was sort of rock and roll time and anything would go. And there could be jokes about who somebody picked up at the bar last night. Well, that's fine. That was then. But now that's going to rile up a lot of people. Anything that pertains specifically to someone's looks or appearances is really out of bounds. Even very simple things, like one example I give in the book, which is a classic sort of golf joke. The husband comes home and the wife said, "Well, how did it go?" And he said, "Well, you know, it was fine until the sixth hole when Charlie had a heart attack." And the wife says, "Oh, poor Charlie, what happened?" And he said, "Well, you know, he expired on the sixth hole." He said, "So it was really a drag after that, because it was all hit the ball, drag Charlie, hit the ball, drag Charlie." I heard this joke told probably far too many times at various conferences in Palm Springs, right up through the 90s into, you know, the end of the last century, as it were. And, you know, people would always laugh depending on if the joke teller, number one, was skilled at telling it. Number two, if he had a high enough rank in the organization, everybody would yuck it up. But today, it wouldn't work. For example, I mean, a lot of younger people would think, how is this relevant? Sounds like the wife is at home waiting for the husband to come back from a golf game. This isn't a situation I identify with. Or people who had had a relative who'd had a heart attack would be prone to think, well, that's not funny. That wasn't how people thought 30, 40, 50 years ago. It just wasn't. So people need to be a little more careful, but very importantly, we cannot ban humor from the workplace. We absolutely can't do it. It is one of the most important qualities that helps people bond and create relationships, and it makes work more fun. So we can't get into a very uptight situation where we're constantly scanning the room to think, who could this offend? Who could this offend? Oh, better not do this. Oh, better keep my mouth shut. Much better is to create an environment where we look at things that are obviously meant to be offensive, and there are a lot of them, and things that might misfire a little bit, like that hit the ball, drag Charlie joke. They might misfire. Somebody think, wow, I had a so-and-so just had a heart attack. How is that going to play with them? And we need to be, I think, a little less hard on people unless we perceive that they were really trying to be provocative and offensive. It's also important to try to find the humor in situations rather than dragging in jokes, because jokes rely for their power on their capacity to be provocative and to some degree outrageous. They cross boundaries. That's what they do. That's where that sort of twist that makes a joke funny comes from. And so having an awareness that let's find the humor in our situation, in self-deprecating humor, making fun of yourself, not too much, but enough, when something goes wrong, when you say something stupid. That is especially effective if you're in a position with some degree of power.
Okay. Well, Sally, we talked about a few behaviors and habits that are great in terms of giving people the benefit of the doubt and watching yourself and your triggers. And if you're just writing people off and constructing self-flattering narratives that are defensive left and right. Are there any other key inclusive behaviors that make a world of difference for folks and organizations?
Oh, certainly. You know, one of the things that I really heard a lot about when I was working on the book was the power of nominating other people for awards. And one of the women I interviewed, she said, I really learned a lot about creating allies from a much older executive, she said, when I was very early in my career. And this executive came up to me and he said, you know, I am trying to see if I can get a certain number of nominations for, it was some big award in the industry. And he said, I'm wondering if you would nominate me. So she said she was shocked on two fronts. Number one, she said she was shocked because she didn't know that that's how it was done. That people who got awards often lobbied for it. She said, I just thought they got awards. She said, I never really thought it through. She was early in her career at that time. She said, I was also astonished that someone who was at such a senior level would ask someone junior like me. She said, again, that really, really, I didn't know you could do that. She said, and it made her very aware that this is something that you can do that earns you tremendous gratitude from your colleagues, is not only agreeing to nominate them, but volunteering to nominate them. You know, you've really been good in this job. And I saw that whatever it is, whatever entity it is taking nominations for people who are outstanding in our sector. I thought that I might nominate you. How would that be? Well, this is something that people really, really respond to. And again, I think it's important to recognize this is something that we can do really early in our careers. We can also ask people, what would be helpful to them. Again, we can do this even if we're very junior in our career. We can recognize that part of our job is always going to be trying to make our bosses, our leaders, the people we work for, part of our job is making them look good. So we can be clear about this and we can say, you know, I understand that I want you to look good in this initiative. Is there anything I can do that would be especially useful to you in letting the people in the organization know what a terrific job our team is doing and therefore you as our team leader? So asking a question like that can really be eye-opening, and it does a couple things. You solicit some ideas for how you could be helpful, but it also suggests to the person that you say that to that you really understand how things work in an organization and that you're not naive about it. You understand and accept that part of your job is making them look good. So that kind of puts you on a different footing than you might have been before. Of course, there are plenty of things senior people can do as well. You know, what talents do you have that you feel you may not be using? Do you have any skills in this job that you would particularly like to develop? Is there anybody you would like to meet that I might know who could be helpful to you in the future? Those kinds of questions, we don't ask those kinds of questions enough wherever we are in our careers.
All right. Well, Sally, tell me, anything else you want to make sure to mention before we shift gears and hear about some of your favorite things?
A couple of things I do want to mention is this is very hard to do. It's very hard to try to identify when we're being triggered and then think of a different path of action. And we will always be more successful at it if we are bringing other people along on our journey. If we, you know, this is part of this theme of asking, of saying, you know, one thing I'm really trying to work on, fairness is a trigger in the book we didn't talk about. One thing I'm really trying to work on is coming to a better understanding of what is fair and what isn't fair in this organization, because I realize that I often think something is unfair, but it may not be as unfair as I think it is. Or I often recognize that something is actually much more unfair than I was thinking it was. Can I bounce my ideas off you once I have a perception about this and kind of get your thoughts on it? So it's a kind of seat of the pants peer coaching where we engage other people in our own development, in this case, our development as we try to think about what undermines us in terms of building strong relationships really broadly.
Okay, thank you. Well, now could you share with us a favorite quote, something you find inspiring?
I think a favorite quote of mine, because it's one that I use virtually every day, and I referenced it a bit earlier, comes from the really terrific old self-help book by Stephen Covey, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And it was, always seek to discern what lies within your circle of control and to align it with your circle of concern. In other words, don't waste your time trying to address whatever concerns you, but you can't control. And in fact, probably don't spend too much time being concerned about it if you can't control it.
And a favorite study or experiment or bit of research?
I would say that the research done by Daniel Kahneman, who has basically invented the whole field of behavioral economics, about how people don't always or even often do what really serves their own long-term interest, that we're often a lot more irrational and reactive in terms of how we respond to everything, ranging from how we manage our financial lives to the decisions we make about where we live or how we interact with our families, that we often make decisions that don't serve our own interests. And I think this work was so important because it brought a whole recognition of the fact that humans are not as rational as they imagine themselves to be into the discussion. And in fact, that's really influenced a lot of my thinking about how triggers operate. We tend to be triggered by things and respond in ways that do not serve our interest.
And a favorite book?
I think my favorite book, in fact, I know this because I start most of my days reading it, is Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, which translates as a manual for power. It is a complete listing of deeply counterintuitive insights about the nature of power and how we use it, especially in the R.W. Wing translation. I find it a fantastic way to begin every day. Real insights into human behavior and how to understand human behavior, but also use it in ways that serve what we're trying to be and contribute in the world.
Okay. And a favorite tool, something you use to be awesome at your job?
What I use to be awesome at my job is basically Word documents. I'm a writer, and my preferred method for communicating with the world is, and always has been since I was a little child, writing. And I find Word such an improvement upon typewriters and that sort of stuff we used to use to try to erase words on typewriters. So I just absolutely love it and couldn't live without it.
And a favorite habit, something you do that helps you be awesome at your job?
My favorite habit, I think, is my ability to admit vulnerability. When I don't have a skill, when I'm not good at something, I don't try to cover it up. And I think that really helps me. I deal with a lot of things all day long. And if I had to spend energy trying to pretend I was good at what I'm not good at it, I don't think I'd have much success.
And is there a key nugget you share that really seems to connect and resonate with folks? You hear them quote it back to you often?
I think it relates to something that I said earlier, that it's easier to act our way into new ways of thinking than to think our way into new ways of acting. Since my work has been focused upon the hows for the last 35, 40 years, that really resonates with me. I think we want to act in thoughtful ways, learn from how we act, and then let that shape what our opinions and our views are.
Okay. And if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
Well, to my website, sallyhelgeson.com, and I'm active on Twitter and LinkedIn.
All right. And do you have a final challenge or call to action for folks looking to be awesome at their jobs?
Yes, I do. Being awesome at your job requires a little bit of humility, a little bit of willingness to recognize when your stock responses do not serve you, but it doesn't require self-effacement. We should never equate being humble with being humiliated. We can be humble and acknowledge what we need to learn without beating ourselves up or telling ourselves a negative story about who we are or what we're trying to do in the world.
All right. Sally, this has been a treat. I wish you much luck and fun and rising.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you so much.
I really dig Sally's paradigm shift there. It's easier to act our way into new ways of thinking than to think our way into new ways of acting. Like whenever there's a roadblock associated with change, that's a good one to go back to. I also really appreciate that power question. I think I'm going to be using it many times in conversation in terms of, did you mean this? Is that what you meant? It's like, oh, no, I'm sorry. Get that clarification before an escalation. You tweet that. Get clarification before an escalation. Again, the show notes, the transcript, and the links to items we've referenced are over at awesomeatyourjob.com/EP848. Hope to catch you next time. And peace.
Thanks for listening. To get the most out of the show, we recommend two key things. First, check out the extra resources at awesomeatyourjob.com. You can find this episode's transcript and links, as well as the perfect episode for your situation. You can search the full text transcripts of hundreds of episodes or explore episodes tagged by topic and competency covered. Second, subscribe to the podcast and get future episodes automatically. You can subscribe by telling Siri and several other smartphones and speakers, subscribe to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, or by tapping subscribe in your podcast player of choice. If you'd like some extra help figuring out podcasts and how subscriptions work, visit awesomeatyourjob.com/subscribe for guidance. Hope to catch you on the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.